You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gabriel Thompson has ripped chicken breasts apart with his hands, harvested 2,500 heads of lettuce in a single morning, and braved Manhattan streets as a bicycle delivery man. He worked at those and other low-paying jobs when he went undercover 2 years ago, working among a mix of immigrants and native-born Americans, and he's written about those experiences in Working in the Shadows, a year of doing the jobs most Americans won't do. It's published by Nation Books. I'm very pleased that it brings Gabriel Thompson to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Now, you call this book Working in the Shadows, so you're suggesting that people are unaware of the people you were working with?
I'm not sure. I think people kind of have an idea that immigrants are doing a lot of hard work, but it's an abstract sort of idea. And what I wanted to do is make that concrete by going out into jobs that, you know, are often we don't have access to.
And you assumed that you'd be spending this time working alongside immigrants, but didn't you discover that some people born in this country also work at these bottom-level jobs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew that there would be some overlap. In the lettuce fields of Yuma, Arizona, where I started out, there was no overlap. I never saw another white person. But in this poultry plant in rural Alabama, definitely you had native whites and blacks also working alongside Guatemalan immigrants and Mexican immigrants. So it was definitely a mix.
Did you see this as a kind of a nickeled and dimed for immigrants?
I guess so. I mean, my initial inspiration wasn't nickel and dimed. It was I'd read an article in the Times about how an immigration raid at a hog slaughterhouse had caused, you know, more than 1,000 immigrants to leave. And they started recruiting more among U.S. Workers. And the pay was okay, but the turnover rates for the new workers were really high. And they described how nauseating the work was, how sore their hands were. And I thought, you know, I've written about immigrants for a long time, but I have no idea what that work is like, and maybe there's an opportunity for me to go in and do some of these jobs.
One of the arguments that people have against immigrants coming to this country is that they take jobs away from Americans. Do you think that the situation has changed a little bit over the last year or so with this new economic downturn and the high unemployment rate?
I think if most Americans went and tried to get the jobs I got, they'd get them without a problem. You know, in each place I showed up within a week, I would get hired, sometimes within a day.
Were they surprised that you were looking for these jobs?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in Arizona, they were surprised just because it was like, what are you doing here?
You were the only non-Mexican.
I was only non-Mexican, and they attempted to promote me twice just when I walked through the door, once to be a bilingual forklift driver, another job to work indoors. In the chicken plant, that's where I really expected to come under scrutiny because for one thing, I'm from New York City. I have a New York driver's license. And where I was very rural, about 30 miles east of the Mississippi border. It's in a town called Russellville. It's not the kind of place that someone from New York City just happens to sort of be passing through and think it might be a good place to find work.
But go ahead.
I would say what I found out was that the turnover in this industry is so high that I was just another, you know, number in the order. And I mean, someone told me about a week where they had hired 150 new workers at the plant, which is about 10% of the workforce. And in that week, 175 people quit. So when you have such high turnover, you know, I'm just another guy passing through.
And why are they quitting? Because of the physical demands of these jobs?
Poultry work is really, it's hard to capture in words how difficult it is to stay with the job. You have to imagine that in most of the positions, you're standing in one place, it's freezing cold, you've got earplugs on so you can't actually speak to your coworkers, and you're making one motion, like I was tearing chicken breasts in half with my hands, over and over and over again. You do that for a few days and your mind just starts going a little weird.
In your case, you're also a vegetarian, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a vegetarian since grade school, and so I looked in the poultry work not only as fascinating but also, you know, with some trepidation. There are passages in the book that people tell me sound gross, and I'm just writing kind of what happens with chicken fat on my face and all this.
But you weren't killing the chickens. Somebody else had that job.
Right, someone else had that job. They pay a little bit more to work on the killing floor. But what happens very quickly is you actually become desensitized to it, or you leave. But you're not going to be you're not going to be sensitive to what you're doing and be able to keep doing it.
You actually couldn't get yourself transferred to the deboning department, which was a lower on the scale than the job you were doing.
Yeah, you know, I could see that although the plant had a kind of diverse workforce, generally the immigrants were doing some of the hardest work. And one of the hardest positions in a chicken plant is the debone line, where you have 38 birds passing by you and you've got a knife and you're making an identical cut, you know, upwards of 15,000 times in a shift.
Now, you were a good worker. Why were you fired?
I was a good worker, I think.
Well, you say you were a good worker. I believe you.
Well, what happened was I really wanted to... So I was living in a trailer right next to the plant, and all day I worked the graveyard shift. So during the day, you'd have these trucks passing by full of live chickens. And so I had a sense of how the chickens were being killed and dismembered and sort of... But I didn't get to see how the chickens were being grown in the farms that were all around. So I biked out one day. I didn't have a car, so I biked out one day to a farm that I knew was nearby and asked if I could get a tour of the farm. Gave the guy a little too much information, just trying to, like, you know, gain his confidence. And he contacted the plant saying...
This guy's a journalist.
And basically what they decided is I couldn't have access because of some biosafety reasons. But then they realized what I was doing. The HR guy went to my website, ordered my books, signed up for my email newsletter. So it was a very strange, but then that next night called me in and fired me.
Was this something that happened at any other job? Did they figure out? I mean, I would assume that any number of people would have been suspicious.
No, it never happened at any other job. And I was pretty good at not telling people anything, which is an interesting experience to spend 2 months in a town where you don't know anyone and spend all your waking hours with people and not actually be able to tell them exactly why you're there.
You attended a meeting of a white power group called the Council of Conservative Citizens. Is conservative a euphemism for white power in that region?
I don't think so. I think these folks were the sort of right extreme. And, you know, I was sensitive to the idea that I'm like a Yankee going down to the South, and it's very easy to sort of fall into that narrative of everyone in South is a total racist. And I wasn't really looking to do that. However, I had gotten to the town and didn't have anything to do and went online and found that actually the town that I was working in had had a KKK march in 2006. So I was online trying to get more information about that. And through a couple of...
That's fairly recent, 2006.
Yeah, it's fairly recent.
And is this because there is a large black population there? Because that's where the KKK usually was involved? Or is it because of this influx of Latino immigrants?
In that particular circumstance, it was because of the influx of Latino immigrants, and it was because there had been all these huge shows of power in the spring of 2006, all across the country, with Latinos marching. What happened in Russellville, it's interesting, you see on the news when that happened, I remember very clearly in New York City marching with tens of thousands of people, San Jose, Dallas. But you also have these small anonymous towns in the South where in Russellville, everyone had looked at immigrants as very quiet, sort of God-fearing, and they were willing to put up with them to an extent as long as they were seeing it that way. They pulled off, with one day of planning, they pulled off a 500-person march through downtown Russellville, waving Guatemalan and Mexican flags. And that really, I think, had a more profound impact than even these huge, huge marches in cities, because suddenly people had to reevaluate, wow, first of all these immigrants were in one place. They're used to them being scattered around trailers. And they had to kind of realize that their town was changing, and it was kind of a necessary but painful process.
Well, there was a documentary about a town in Virginia where there was an influx of Latino immigrants. And they passed all sorts of laws to make it impossible for them to stay there over the objections of the police chief. And the immigrants left, and the economy of the town went down, really was suffered as a result. After all, they were working at certain jobs, but also they were buying stuff at the grocery store. I don't know what would happen to a place like Russellville.
Yeah, you know, I came, after knowing about the KKK march, I came into Russellville expecting to find a lot of animosity. One of the very surprising discoveries for me was it wasn't there. The amount of animosity I expected to find, the whole notion that immigrants are taking our jobs is a powerful one that can make people angry. But concretely on the ground in Russellville, no one felt that way because the jobs were ones that anyone could go get. Surviving them was difficult. And so when I was on the during breaks on the processing floor, you'd hear people, blacks, whites, Guatemalans, Mexicans, all sort of getting along, often just sharing curse words or sharing snacks. But I did not find the intense hostility that I was expecting.
My guest is Gabriel Thompson, who's written for the New York New York Magazine, The Nation, The New York Times, Brooklyn Rail, In These Times, and other publications. And he's written a book called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. It is published by Nation Books. You mentioned that you worked in the lettuce fields in Arizona for Dole?
For Dole.
I thought they were in the pineapple business in Hawaii.
They are huge, as I realize. They're like the biggest, you know, fresh fruits, vegetables. They do all sorts of things. And I going to Dole was just a random. I checked into a motel and I asked the manager, you know, where's a good company to go? And she said Dole. And I figured, Dole's got name recognition. Might as well try them out first.
And it's interesting because you actually paid above minimum wage. We always assume that farm workers are paid below minimum wage.
Yeah. My situation in Yuma was, I mean, Yuma is a little bit different than most farm working situations. Usually you might have undocumented immigrants in the middle of nowhere being abused, having labor contractors that take advantage of them. Yuma has a very sort of stable history of farm work. And people crossing the border. And so a lot of the Mexicans I worked with that would cross the border occasionally, they had a sense of what their rights were as workers. And that, I think, played a big role in it.
When you say cross the border, they cross the border legally.
They did.
There are certain laws that allow for these people to come over the border every day and work and then go back home across the border to Mexico?
Yeah, the crew I worked on, not very many farm workers are guest workers, very, very few. But where I was and the crew I was put on was predominantly guest workers who were there to sort of fill slots that Dole said they wouldn't be able to find locals to fill, which I think, you know, considering that there were some crews where you could make $15 an hour and yet I never saw anyone else in the fields, I think there's some truth to that.
Well, how did cutting lettuce affect you personally?
Well, I'll
I mean, physically, did it? You're bent over all day, aren't you, just doing this, another one of those repetitive actions?
It is, but the main difference between lettuce and chicken is that lettuce, to me, was an incredibly skilled job. So by the end of my second month was only when I started keeping up with the crew. And my impression was you kind of bend down, you pick lettuce, and you just throw it on. But you don't pick lettuce. You cut lettuce with a knife. And the lettuce is huge in the field. It looks nothing like what the lettuce is in the produce. So you have to bend down, stab the lettuce, separate it, then lift it up and cut it again and trim it and peel off all the outer leaves, then bag it from bags that are hanging at your waist. And you have to do that on long days maybe 3,000 times. And you also have to look for bad lettuce that's been ruined in whatever way. So it's sort of the combination of being incredibly punishing physically, but also needing a lot of skill. And of course, until you get your endurance built up, it's hard to work with skill when you're exhausted.
Farm workers are reported to have a shorter life expectancy than the rest of us. Is that true?
I think it's true, and I think it's not only true that the punishing nature of the work contributes to that, but that farm workers often are in very isolated areas where they don't have access to good health care. They're often, you know, among only Spanish speakers in an area where maybe the labor contractor is their only connection to the outside world.
What about pesticides, manure pits and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a whole host of issues like that. It was towards the end of my time in Yuma when I finally realized we got to a field that we were working in, and the field had all these little bugs in the lettuce and on the ground. And I had been spending, you know, you work in the field all day, and then when you take breaks, you basically collapse on the ground. And I realized it was the first time I'd seen a bug in the field, which is just, you know, it was the first time I really thought, oh, wow, I'm in nature here. And I asked the foreman, you know, Luis, like, there's a lot of bugs here. And I asked, how come we've never seen bugs before? He said, oh, we have very good fumigation. And I was like, you know, I guess it's good if you consider it good that it kills everything but which is necessary to grow lettuce, but it makes you suspicious about what the impact of that might be on the workers.
How did your fellow workers feel about the job? Would they want their children to follow in their footsteps?
Generally, no. I think the story of immigration is not only a story of wanting to better your own situation, but really it's, you know, why I'm here, why maybe you're here, is the notion that you want your kids to have more.
But guest workers they're working under a special deal. They can't be upwardly mobile, can they?
Well, but they all hope to, you know, for example, one of the questions they kept asking me was, do I have any sisters or cousins that they might want to get to know or might want to get to know them. So I think they're all sort of ideally would like to end up finding someone and figuring out a way to come to the U.S.
This is an all-male world?
No, farm workers is actually there was, I think it's about 40%. One of the surveys I looked at was about 40% female. And you have a lot of families. So you have like the woman and the husband and wife actually working as a team, which was interesting. And the women, there were certain differences. I mean, women would wear bandanas across their faces, sort of look like Zapatistas. You know, it's a very militant look. And I asked, well, how come none of the men do that? The sun's pretty strong on our skin, too. And I have white, pasty skin. Any problem with me doing that? And everyone laughed and said, no, that's just not the way it goes. But no, it was definitely, I think one of the reasons is why there are more females is that in Yuma, there's a lot of commuting back and forth, so families can go. Often, if it's undocumented immigrants, it might just be the mail that crosses.
What percentage of the people you worked with were undocumented?
In across the border in Arizona. Like, because in Arizona, I would say now when I worked with them, none of them were. A lot of them had been in the past. But I showed up in Arizona right when they had passed a very tough employer sanctions law. So they were either legal residents or guest workers. In New York City, where I worked as a bicycle delivery boy, I'd say everyone, pretty much, and most of the people in the back of the kitchen. In Alabama, it was a mix. You had some Guatemalan, and the reason there was an exception there, like, was that some of the Guatemalan immigrants had gotten asylum because they'd been persecuted and members of their family had been killed in the 80s during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also were offered the option of joining a union. Is everybody at the lettuce farm offered that?
No, I think very few farm workers belong to unions. I mean, it's kind of an untold story that the UFW, as great as its history is, has virtually no presence in farm work right now. I think they may have somewhere about 5,000 members across the country. And I was a member of the Teamsters, but that was a Teamsters local that had been representing the same workers for a long, long time. But there is definitely room, I think, for a new farm worker movement to come up to aggressively organize farm workers, because it's very hard to imagine serious progress without that taking place.
Well, the union would probably get them health insurance and some other benefits, but the guest workers obviously are not getting that. Do the unions ask people if they're legal or illegal?
No. I mean, I think that the main issue about if you're undocumented is it makes the boss has a very powerful weapon when he comes to them and says why you should not vote for the union. I saw you talking to a union organizer. You know, it's probably not good to talk to them. And if you talk to them some more, it might cause problems for you. And they don't have to say it explicitly, but what it means is we know you're in the country illegally, and if you do something that I don't like, I'm going to try to make sure that you get deported.
And power seems to be a big issue here. Well, let me get into that in just a moment. My guest is Gabriel Thompson, who has written a book called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. It's published by Nation Books. You worked in New York, and in one of the jobs it seemed like the boss really enjoyed that power to the point where that caused you trouble.
Yeah, that's, you know, it was interesting to think back on it now because I came from lettuce and chicken and returned to New York where I live and where it's a lot more familiar, and I was excited about it. Like, I thought of it as it's going to get easier now. And I found work in the Flower District, you know, and I thought, I knew that most of the workers there were immigrants, and I thought that'd be a great little experience for me, also kind of selfishly an easier experience for me, and that it presented a different type of work environment where it's a mom and pop shop. I'd been working for huge companies and thought this would be sort of friendly. What I discovered was that, and I think this happens all over the city, is that there are these storefronts that are sort of sweatshops hidden in plain sight where you have a couple of people, maybe one boss or two bosses, who run it as their kingdom, and they have their workers, and they don't expect to get any government agencies in there to monitor them, and so they kind of can do what they want. And that was a new experience for me, not just for the book, but for my entire life of regularly being shouted at and insulted and demeaned at loud volume. And never having the chance to kind of shout back and kind of keep your head down and do whatever they do and learn to take it.
So you just smiled and that caused you trouble?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what there's two reasons that they fired me after 2 days. I mean, it's odd that they hired me in the first place, considering that they didn't pay minimum wage, they didn't pay overtime, they didn't give you any breaks. But I think the two things that made them very uncomfortable was, one, they saw that I was speaking Spanish with coworkers, and two, I have this sort of defense mechanism of when someone's being outrageously inappropriate to me, like abusing or assaulting me, I'll just kind of smile a little bit to mentally distance myself. And when they called me in to fire me, they said, you know, your antics as a happy chicken, it just doesn't work out here. And I think what they're saying is, we'd like our employees sort of really to, even if they're not beaten down, we want them to look as if they're beaten down. And
many of the owners of these businesses immigrants themselves?
Yeah, I mean, these
do they hire people from the country they come from?
No, like these bosses were actually immigrants from, I believe, Greece. And so it was an interesting sort of juxtaposition that it's how one immigrant group can be so abusive towards another immigrant group.
And they weren't paying minimum wage, you say?
Well, they didn't. For me, they didn't pay minimum wage. When I spoke to workers and they would tell me, well, when they hired me, they wouldn't tell me how much they're going to pay me. So I was talking to a couple of workers about, any idea how much I should expect to be paid here? And he said, one of the guys said, when I started, I ended up being paid about $5 an hour without, you know, and also they're working like 20 hours overtime, but that doesn't get included. So I think that's pretty typical of a lot of these.
Minimum wage is over $7 now.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, New York has a much stronger history of unionization than some of the places you worked in the South. But that doesn't carry through for the low-wage jobs that you were taking here.
No, I think it's a big challenge, and there's a lot of incredible work going on in terms of maybe not just labor unions but community-based organizations that are organizing aggressively among groups like delivery workers, cooks, like jobs that haven't traditionally been targets of unions. And I think that's, you know, very promising. These are very savvy, very media savvy groups that have deep ties to the communities in which they're organizing. There's promise there, but it's true. You know, there was a report came out a little while ago about how restaurants in Park Slope weren't paying their delivery workers the minimum wage that they owed. And there's kind of people in Park Slope are outraged. But that's not a Park Slope problem. That's any delivery guy pretty much that comes that delivers even here at WNYC, chances are they're being paid about $2 an hour.
On the other hand, if you get a job, a really low-paying job in a restaurant, there is an opportunity to move up. There are any number of chefs or people in the top of the line in restaurants who started at the most menial jobs. But most of the jobs you worked at, there really was nowhere to go.
Yeah, theoretically, I think like a dishwasher in the restaurant that I worked. First, there's a certain what I found is a perversity of wage scale in restaurants where, from what I saw, dishwashers probably had the most difficult job in terms of they're covered in it's very humid. They're covered in leftovers. The pace at which they have to clean plates is incredibly high, and they're making minimum wage. It always struck me as odd that. They didn't the sort of tip sharing relationship didn't include someone like a dishwasher because I'm not a huge food person, but I would always be very upset and feel like my meal was ruined if the dish wasn't clean, you know. So I think there's a server obviously goes and explains the specials and they play an important role, but it seems odd that they get all these tips. Meanwhile, some of the people that are way in the back, but that serve an increasingly important role. Don't see any of it.
Well, it seems to me from reading this book that it's a lot more difficult doing these jobs than running a major bank, and yet we don't give these guys million-dollar bonuses. What's wrong with our society?
Well, I think for one thing, I try not to go into too much editorializing because I think part of what I'd like this book to play as a role is just sort of describing things that people might not be aware of. I know for me, You know, you can know farm work is hard, but until I spent a couple of months cutting lettuce, that's when I came back and was in grocery stores, and I would spend 15 minutes looking kind of psychotic in the produce aisles, turning over every head of lettuce, seeing, admiring the cuts, trying to imagine where it had come from. And I think, you know, like if you walked down a produce aisle and you had a little photo and a quick little profile of the farm worker that cut that prepared and that the produce you're about to enjoy, it would go sort of a long ways towards connecting. Because the truth is, all of these jobs are so connected. You go to KFC and you buy something, you're connected to the immigrant workers that I found in Alabama. When you grab a head of lettuce in the grocery store, very likely the last person to touch a head of lettuce was a farm worker who harvested it.
Gabriel Thompson's book is called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. It is published by The Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thanks.